Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Thanks, Walt. I just got back from a really good trip in Ireland. We'll be talking a lot more about that country in our interview today. But first, I wanted to mention a couple of very interesting things in the news. One was that on November 16th, the Wall Street Journal came out with an article glowingly touting the virtues of the Bank of North Dakota, the publicly owned Bank of North Dakota. It said that the Bank of North Dakota was more profitable and had a better credit rating than J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, that it was outdistancing the Wall Street banks. So that was great for the public banking movement. The problem, as usual, as the major media always does, the author, Chester Dawson, credited the oil boom in North Dakota. So naturally, I disagreed, and I had to write an article about it, which is the subject of my latest post on my blog at ellenbrown.com. You could get away with arguably saying that the reason the state is doing so well is because of the oil boom. But the author himself says that the reason that the Bank of North Dakota is doing so well is that the state got extra revenue and therefore it's put its deposits in the bank. Well, so it has excess deposits. That does not explain why it's so profitable. We already know that J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America have a huge stock of excess deposits. So that does not explain how the Bank of North Dakota would be outdistancing them in profitability and in credit ratings and so forth. And it's not what you might think, that the Bank of North Dakota is going out there and hustling and using their excess profits to make loans, whereas Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase aren't doing it. In fact, strangely, and I don't really know how to explain this, but in fact, the Bank of North Dakota also is just investing their excess deposits in securities. So their loan-to-deposit ratio has actually gone down by a third or a half relative to where it was in 2009. Another reason that that explanation fails is that the oil boom did not actually hit until 2010 in North Dakota. And North Dakota was already the only state that had escaped the credit crisis, boarding a budget surplus every year or every quarter or whatever, in the spring of 2009. And the Bank of North Dakota actually had a higher return on equity in 2009 than it had in the boom years of 2010 to 2014. It was higher by the difference of, in 2014, I think it's 18.5%, and in 2009 it was 23.5%, quite a bit higher. So the oil boom won't explain it, and I've got all the data on when the oil boom hit, etc., on my blog if you want to check it out, ellenbrown.com. So that raises the question, what does explain the Bank of North Dakota's great success? And I would argue that it's that very thing that the major media is always trying to sweep under the rug by pointing to the oil boom. It's that public banks are simply more efficient and more profitable than private banks. One reason is that their profits are not shipped offshore into offshore tax havens, but rather are recycled back to the bank and back to the state and back to the community. Another thing is that their costs are extremely low. They don't have to advertise for deposits since 98% of their deposits come from the state itself. They've only got one branch in the capital city, and since only 2% of their depositors are individuals, they don't need many tellers, maybe two or three, I'm guessing. I don't know. I haven't actually been there. They don't pay FDIC insurance because they're self-insured. They don't pay bonuses, fees, or commissions. They don't pay exorbitant executive salaries. they don't even try to compete with the other banks. They actually partner with the local banks. So they let the local bank, in effect, be the front office that negotiates the loan with the customer. And then the Bank of North Dakota comes in and participates in the loan, helps with capital and liquidity. And their borrowing costs are very low. So for all those reasons, they are simply a more efficient model. And other studies have found that too, looking at public banks abroad. Even though they're not trying to be more profitable, they are just because their costs are so low. So we already knew that, but it was good of the Wall Street Journal to come out with an article confirming that public banks are more efficient and more profitable than private banks, even the big Wall Street private banks. The other thing I wanted to talk about was the G20 summit in Brisbane, Australia last weekend. If you heard anything about it, it was probably that Russian President Vladimir Putin left early after being rather rudely made into a punching bag by some of the other illustrious leaders. What you probably didn't hear, unless you frequent the alternative media, is that the G20 has now made bail-in official. So that means that your deposits are no longer your money. They're just IOUs of the bank, and if the bank should go insolvent, it's actually legally required to confiscate your deposits and turn them into equity. So instead of being a liability of the bank, they, by a very neat accounting trick, they move it off the liability side of the balance sheet into the equity portion, which means that instead of having a deposit account that you can write checks on, you now have stock in a bankrupt bank. So I'll be writing more on that in my next article. And now it's time to talk to our charming guests who are calling all the way from Ireland. They are actively working to get public banks set up in Ireland, which is a country that sorely needs some financial help. Ireland's main problem is that, unlike England, they are a member of the Eurozone, which means they can't issue their own money and they can't borrow from their own central bank. And they've been sort of extorted into borrowing from the Troika, the IMF, the ECB, and the EU. That's actually a problem for the whole Eurozone model, that they can't borrow from their own central banks. And the ECB has a rule that it doesn't lend to governments. It only lends to banks. Fortunately, there happens to be an exception in the Lisbon Treaty that sets out the rule that says that publicly owned banks can borrow from the ECB. So while governments are reduced to paying whatever interest the market can extort out of them, such as at one point Greece was actually paying 30% interest, if it happens to own some public banks, its public banks can borrow from the ECB at under 1%. So that's one of many reasons why public banks would be a good idea in Ireland. I've been speaking with Noel Kinahan and Emer Oshakru, who have been helping to lead the national effort in Ireland for putting public banking forward as a possible solution to that country's monetary crisis. My guests today are Noel Kinahan and Emer Oshakru, who are both members of the recently formed Public Banking Forum of Ireland and are very active and knowledgeable in local Irish politics. Emer was my gracious hostess on my recent trip to Ireland, and Noel was chief planner and bodyguard. It was a very enjoyable and productive trip, and I'm delighted to get to speak to them again now. Greetings, Noel and Emer.
Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Ellen. How you doing?
I want to talk about the progress of the public banking movement in Ireland and all your efforts to bring public awareness to it. But first, I thought it would be good to lay the groundwork for our listeners who might not be totally savvy on the Irish scene. So I wondered if you'd like to talk about Ireland's economy and the problems you've had with your banks, what went wrong with the banks, and why the taxpayers agreed to bail them out and so forth, the general lay of the land in Ireland.
Okay, well, maybe I'll start. It's a long story and a sad one. It started off that Ireland had a genuine economic boom back in the 1990s when productivity went up. We got a lot of foreign investments from corporations. We also got a lot of investment from the EU, and we spent that money well. And the economy really took off. But it all changed about the year 2000, when instead of expanding our GDP by productive investment, we began to cannibalize, in a way, our own economy by expanding the property sector. And loans gradually shifted from productive investment to investment in land in particular and property generally. And there was a huge property bubble, which was fed by the major Irish banks and foreign banks that came in to enjoy the bonanza. And in the end of the day, we didn't have what you had in America of poor quality loans. We really had loans to very few large developers, maybe a handful of large developers. And they were into the banks for about $60 billion. And a lot of that was essentially borrowed on the interbank market from overseas, mainly the UK, but also America and Germany and so on. And at a certain point, after Lehman's went belly up, that money dried up essentially. They couldn't borrow anymore on the open market. And we were looking at a liquidity crisis. At least that's what they thought it was at the beginning. The
developers. Do you want to explain liquidity crisis?
Well, I'm not sure if I can explain this very well, but essentially, yeah, the money dried up that was propping up the Irish banks that was needed to keep expanding, essentially. It was on a roll and had to keep rolling until they could develop their sites and sell off and realize their profits.
I'll just interject. Liquidity crisis is really where banks have actually double used their money. I mean, all banks do this. They double book it. So they purport to have your deposits there in the bank, but at the same time that they've actually lent them out. So the way they deal with both the depositor and the borrower coming for their money at the same time is that they have these credit lines with other banks. So that's called liquidity, the ability to turn assets into money that you can pay out, cash that you can pay to the customers when they come for it. So it's really the inherent flaw in the banking system. All banks run on liquidity like that or run on credit lines. And if the credit lines dry up, then the banks are in trouble. And that's what happened in 2008.
Yeah. And it was mainly one bank, Anglo-Irish Bank, that the market began to worry about. And even ordinary depositors started removing their money from Anglo-Irish Bank. And essentially, they couldn't keep going. But what our government unfortunately did in October 2008 on that fateful night, they decided to underwrite or guarantee all of our banks at that time, thinking it was only a liquidity problem. It turned out, of course, to be a profitability problem. It was a solvency problem. And that a lot of the property and land that the banks had lent on couldn't really realize the receipts that they had imagined. And the economists in Ireland were saying we're heading towards a soft landing on the property market. But of course, anybody who's read economic history will soon find there's no such thing as a soft landing. You get crashes. You go down very fast. You may rise quite slowly, but you always go down very fast. And this lesson was learned again. And it turns out that a lot of the land that the developers borrowed from the banks for was only worth one-tenth of the value on the books. And essentially what had to happen was our government had to set up a bank called NAMA, essentially a National Asset Management Agency, to buy up these bad developer loans and also refinance. And they bought them at about 50% of the book value. And then they also had to refinance the banks on top of that again. So that was the root cause of the problem. And essentially, we were down about $62 billion, as far as I know. So they raided our pension funds, and then they raided any money that they could get going, essentially propping up the banks. And but the main banks still had liquidity problems, and as far as I know, the ECB was feeding a lot of funds to our banks to keep going. And at a certain point, the ECB said, we're not going to do this anymore. You have to accept a bailout from us. And the condition of that so-called bailout was austerity. So the ECB effectively stopped acting as a financier of our banking system and demanded that we accept funding, I think at about 3%, combined funding from the IMF, the ECB and the European Union. Mm. And that was our bailout. And the condition was that we cut our public debt in total and annually to 3% per annum deficit, I think, and to get it down to 60 billion instead of 100, I think it's 120 billion or so. And the government's been working on that since, and we've had, whatever, 8 years of that.
Yeah, we've had 8 years of that, Ellen, and it's only now they've set up a committee to investigate what type of pressure our politicians are being put under at that time.
I understand there was some apparent fraud involved there, that you were sort of forced into bailing out the banks in the first place, and then you were forced into taking this bailout from the Troika, is that correct?
Well, it was mainly the first guarantee was supposed to be 2 years, essentially, to work its way out. And it was coming to the end of its time in 2010. And that's really where the force came in, when some of the bonds were maturing at that time. So we had the opportunity of not paying those. And that's where a great deal of pressure came down on our politicians, insisting that we pay every last bondholder, including the unsubordinated ones, the ones that weren't normally guaranteed and it's seen as high risk. Every last bondholder. And at that point, they were owned by hedge funds, guys who were taking a punt on it and had bought it on cents on the dollar, essentially. They were nearly all foreign, yeah. So they, apparently champagne corks were flying on that night in 2010.
So there you are in financial difficulties. So how did you get interested in public banking as a solution, and how would that help?
Well, I think, Ellen, at that stage, you know, people were looking at this. There was jobs being lost, etc. And people were looking for some type of alternative. There must be something. How can all this go wrong at the one time? It was around that time you got an invitation to come over here. And some of us had read your book, The Public Banking Solution and the Web of Debt. We looked at this, although it was the US and you had slightly different problems over there, but it was to do with the private banking sector and how the control they had over the system. So a few of us decided to invite you over here, and from there really was the spark to investigate what was happening, because we were not getting the answers from our government. We were not getting solutions. We were not getting alternatives. So some people decided to have a look at this whole situation themselves. They wanted answers and we weren't getting them.
I think that's great that you've taken the initiative and you've gone so far with it.
Yeah, well, following your visit here, and we got some tips, really some good tips, what was happening. But we invited a chap over here called Dr. Thomas Cradell, and I believe he spoke at your last convention, Public Banking Institutional Convention, in, I think it was Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he came over here, and he spoke about this 200-year-old Sparsigan group of public banks. And basically, what their main task was to supply money or credit to the SME market over there.
SME is small and medium sized.
Oh, small and medium enterprises, yeah. You know, the backbone of any society. I mean, they're the guys that create the jobs. They're the guys that pay the taxes, that keep, you know, our politicians in jobs, et cetera, et cetera, apart from big business. So basically, the Sparsigan Group have a foundation called the Foundation for International Cooperation, the SBFIC. They came over to meet some of us, and they sat down and they explained exactly their job was to go to other countries to look at, you know, informing the people about setting up a public bank.
Ireland cannot issue its own money, so it's sort of like a state in the U.S. where, although you can't issue money directly, you can create money the way all banks do in the form of loans. So it would be like one bank probably that would be set up on the Bank of North Dakota model that would service the smaller banks. But the Sparkassen model is something different. They're not, first of all, they're not using public deposits. Is that correct? They're using individual deposits, and they operate like ordinary banks, except that they're publicly owned. Is that correct? Do you want to explain?
That's right. There? Three of our leading political parties, in fact, have a national investment bank in their manifesto. But when they were in power, and they've all had a go at power, none of them brought it in. And it seems to be very difficult to get a national public bank in Ireland. And now it's also obfuscated by the fact that we have a majority shareholding in three pillar banks, they call them. One at nearly 98% shareholding. And people say, isn't that a public bank? Which, of course, it isn't. But we're in the position now that if we brought in an investment bank, it would be in competition with those so-called pillar banks in which we have a huge investment. So that might be the reason why it seems to be very difficult, although there's no real discussion about this. It's amazing. But it seems to be very difficult at this point to bring in a national bank, whereas when we introduced the idea of local public banks, the doors seem to be opening for this idea because it would be less threatening.
Yeah, I think, Ellen, from my investigation and speaking to politicians and senators and anybody I can over here, they don't seem to understand the concept of public banking, because here in Ireland, we've had banks that kind of looked after SMEs in the past, but we wouldn't call them public banks as such. You know, my kind of definition of a public bank is a system where the interest that's earned by this particular bank is folded back into the community. Now, currently, the banking system we have over here, apart from our credit unions, is that, you know, all that interest that's earned from those loans go off to the Cayman Islands or wherever they go to. That's the real money. That's the money without debt. That's what we're looking at. So, you know, there's many different types of, there's probably 40 or 50 models of public banking globally, from Russia to China to all different types that operated different. But when we looked at the Sparkasm model, it seemed to fit the bill. A, it was within the European community. It can deal with the ECB, and because it's German, obviously the Bundesbank. So it knows all the regulations, etc., you know, exactly how banks are set up. But if you
say you can't do it because they've already done it.
here's the thing. You know, we're not just banging on the table here, Ellen, just saying we want public banks because we know the benefits, et cetera, et cetera. We're saying, here, look at this. Here is a model. As it stands in Germany, it's not going to suit the Irish setup through legislation, or there would be have to be changes in small changes in legislation, regulation, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're trying to do here, Ellen, is to try to put a proposal on the table that can't be refused, and to show the benefits of public banking that will sort of bring back our country to prosperity.
You have the same situation we do, where the big banks really aren't interested in the small and medium-sized businesses. So you're talking about servicing a market that's currently not being serviced. Your credit unions are more consumer-type loans, right? But the small
that's
and medium-sized businesses are having trouble getting credit.
If you look closer at the Sparkasm model in Germany, it's been around 200 years. If you look at how they operate, and this is the thing, you know, it's how they give loans to, say, SMEs. We'll just pick on the SMEs for starters. They're local. They work regional. So they will loan to local businesses. The money will be given to them. The interest will come back. That money will be spent local in the area. Now, that's where our politicians over here are starting to look at this idea that I think that could be good for the country. So it's the system, also the way they loan. In other words, if a guy comes up and he has a proposal, or if he has a business plan and he wants to borrow money, the first thing they look at is the business plan to see how successful, you know, that's going to go. They don't look at his collateral, or they don't look at, you know, in case you go bust, you know, what buildings do you have, etc. So they also have a public mandate. And this is what makes a difference. It's about understanding local business, and it's about feeding back into the community, which our pillar banks, our so-called pillar banks, don't operate that way. So it's decentralized.
Literally getting the profit for the government. I mean, the government feeds it back into the community.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's
so
a matter of recycling. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a double win all around. But the trouble is that a lot of our politicians, a lot of people don't understand. You know, people over here, you know, are not happy with the banks. But, you know, you need to come up with a solution. You need to come up with an alternative that can compete with what's out there at the moment. And it's interesting, you know, they're of no use to us, really, you know.
Right.
It's interesting that the government does know there is a problem with lending to SMEs. SMEs are not getting the investment they need to expand or even to continue. And they've set up a new strategic investment banking corporation, not a bank. And it's getting funding from the European Investment Bank and a chunk of funding from the KfW, which is Germany's national public investment bank. And the idea is that this will be a fund. It may get backed up by private funds as well. And something like 200 million to start. And they're going to channel these funds to our so-called pillar banks. And the idea is then at a lower interest rate. And the pillar banks are supposed to make that funding available to Ireland's small and medium businesses. The problem is that nobody has confidence that the Irish banks, those banks, are capable of lending that money. And I think that's one reason why the government likes the idea of local Sparkassen banks on the Sparkassen model, because that's how it operates in Germany. Investment funds are fed from the KfW bank to the 420 smaller banks, the Sparkassen, who know their local businesses, and they're the ones that mediate the lower cost funding. And so the Sparkassen, of course, are very used to working with the KfW in Germany, and I think the KfW would be encouraging our government to enable something similar to the Sparkassen banks in Ireland to ensure that the money they're making available will get spent as it's supposed to be spent, or invested, I should say.
Just to go back to the Sparkassen group, the Sparkassen cannot open banks here because they don't have the mandate to work outside of their own country. But it's the SBFIC, which is the foundation set up to go around the world to help countries set up banks. They're currently in, I think, five or six different countries in Europe. They're in Asia, they're down in South America, and they're asking these people to look at their model. But they've been over here three or four times, Ellen, and they've looked at the situation that we have here, and they've come back with a possible structure, okay? And that would combine, say, post offices, credit unions, and an SME-type bank, and have a kind of a central institution. But this is only a proposal. We're kind of at the situation now where they've been over, they've looked at the system we have here, and what they're doing is they're going away and they're going to come back with a proposal that they can put on the table, and we will look at that closely and then move on to the next stage. So we're probably about two steps away from hopefully our government taking this seriously and looking at the idea of setting up public banks that would suit our economy.
It's interesting that they're going abroad. Our Bank of North Dakota, apparently after I started writing about it, they got flooded with requests from different states about how they did it and how to set up a bank and stuff. And they say, we're not in the business of helping other states set up their banks. You know, figure it out for yourselves, basically. Whereas the Sparkassen are actively going out and trying to spread this model. And the reason, apparently, is that in Europe, they are under threat. There's all this pressure to change the rules so that the public banks really effectively won't be public banks anymore. They have to have the same capital requirements as the private banks, and they have to join the insurance system that will bail out the big banks when they go bankrupt, as you know, when they go insolvent, as they no doubt will, or they already are if you look closely. So the Sparkassen already have their own insurance group where they self-insure each other, And that's perfectly adequate for their model because they are such safe, secure banks. And if you make them incur all these other costs, then you're going to take away the thing that is the advantage of being a public bank, namely that you have the government behind you and therefore you don't need a great big capital base because you are the government. You're the government's banker, or you are the government.
Yeah, well, just to give you an idea of the size of the Sparkassen Bank in Germany, you know, their turnover is probably 1,100 billion a year, okay? Their SME financing in Germany is about 70%. 70%, okay? They have 42% market share of the business finance in January. They have 15,300 branches, and they have approximately 245,000 staff working for them. And you know, what they do, Ellen, is they actually train their own bankers how to loan. And that's the key. That's what's missing. That's what's missing because they, with the public mandate, they look at what the loan is going to be, and it's not just, you know, it's not just profit based all the time, okay? You know, it's not about the shareholders, it's about the community.
They can look beyond the short term profits, right?
That's it, exactly. And I know for a fact, and I know for a fact that some of the banks are not making profits, but you know, through the centralized unit system that they have, they will prop them up, and then later on they come back into profit again. So it's about keeping credit flowing in the system, which will not happen. In other words, they're counter-cyclical. You know, at the moment here, we have a big problem where the private banking system, because of the knocks that they've taken, don't have the money to loan out into the SMEs, which kills business. And in Germany, I know for a fact, looking at the model that they have in Germany, that they've increased since 2008. The amount of money that they're loaning in, but it's fairly carefully loaned. It doesn't mean that they're throwing money at people. You know, you come in, your business plan has to stand up against scrutiny from them.
Yeah, us, I don't know that that would be such a strong selling point because that's an argument against the state setting up its own bank is that, well, the local banks already know how to loan to their businesses and we'll be making bad loans. You know, politicians make bad bankers, which, of course, we're not talking about politicians. We're talking about hiring bankers. But it seems to me just having the expertise is not alone enough to do the public banking model. But what we're talking about here is that the profits go back to the people and the people have control over where the credit goes. Because, like, right now it's just not going to the SMEs because the big banks can make a lot more money giving it to hedge funds and other big regulators. And the little banks have been so squeezed with all these new regulations that they can't meet their capital requirements.
So the big banks are sucking them up. And basically that's, you know, the big banks are getting bigger. You know, it's interesting to note as well that this bank has been around for over 200 years. It's been there when the Berlin Wall came down. They were one of the groups of banks that went to help set up the banking system in East Germany.
One thing about the whole question about the expertise in lending is that we have a very strong credit union movement in Ireland. And I think we have the highest penetration of credit unions per capita in the world, as far as I know. But they lend mainly to consumers for ordinary things like kitchen extensions, holidays, cars, and so on. Some of them did, unfortunately, get a bit ambitious in the boom times and lend against property. So some of the credit unions are in trouble. Now, one thing about the Irish credit unions is that it's more or less entirely voluntary. And that's something that they value in Ireland. And some credit unions are interested in getting into lending to SMEs, but the government is worried about their expertise at that level. And what the Sparkassen offer is expertise and professionalism. They come from Germany where expertise has a very high standing and people demand it. They demand a level of professionalism. They demand training. They demand that you pass exams, that you are also trained on the job. And that's very comforting. So if the Sparkassen type bank in Ireland offers a sort of complementary service to the credit unions, credit unions can keep doing what they do well, which is consumer lending, and then the Sparkassen type banks can lend to SMEs. Now, some credit unions are capable of becoming banks, in which case they can themselves transform into local public banks with the guidance of the Sparkassen Foundation and their training. Sparkassen are able to offer training and embed their own people in our new banks to hold their hands until they learn the new system. In Ireland, that is highly valued because we don't have that expertise either in the larger banks who can simply lend against existing assets, and in the credit unions who really lend for consumer loans against the, I don't know, the character of the borrowers whom they know well.
Yeah, so they're really filling a need. They're not competing with anybody. They would be filling a need that's not currently filled. So I can see where they're very attractive for Ireland. An opportunity I think that Ireland is missing is to have a bank like the Bank of North Dakota, because the difference is you put all your revenues in your own bank and then you get all the profits from that. Instead of those profits, right now all your revenues go into the three big banks that are effectively bankrupt, and they're going to pay off those old debts, and you're not able to use that benefit to generally stimulate the whole economy. So to have such a bank is one way that Eurozone countries can get back that power that they lost by turning it over to the ECB, which we now know is run by Goldman Sachs. And I mean, you know, it has big international private banker influence on it.
Well, it is true that some of the parties, Sinn Féin, for instance, are taking a national public bank very seriously and are investigating that. And indeed, when you look at it, the Strategic Investment Banking Corporation is a prime candidate to be turned into a proper national public bank. And we're saying to them, why not at least prepare for it? So if there is another crisis, at the very least, that we have a plan B, that we could go to our own public bank and create solvency in the system ourselves. And particularly if we had the smaller banks on the ground operating, that we could survive the kind of crisis that we hit in 2008 and then again in 2010. And, I think they're listening to us. But the thing is to get the expertise to develop that up. Even the politicians themselves find it difficult to get the research resources. And so we're delighted to be working with yourselves in the U.S., and if we can get further partners in Europe to identify the experts that can advise the Department of Finance here and the politicians on how exactly to do it.
So what do you think of the whole Eurozone model, and was it a mistake to join the EU, and why did Ireland join the EU?
Well, I take no responsibility. I always voted against it. But in fairness, I think people voted for the euro without knowing what it meant. So it seems to have been the case that the economists at the highest level knew it wouldn't work, but they were hoping that the political changes that were necessary to make it work would be kind of forced into coming into being, that the economic pressures would enable the political changes that were necessary for a single currency to work, which is a very underhand thing to do in a so-called democracy.
Yes, we're forcing everybody into a United States of Europe, whereas our states have agreed to be one country and to be under the rule of one government.
Yeah, that is the case. I mean, it would still, and then some people do argue that Ireland should leave the euro, but it would be very disruptive. Well, it would be less disruptive if Germany would leave the euro, because then our debts would remain in probably a devalued currency, and their new Euro-German currency would go up in value. But that may not happen. But other ideas have been floated, as you know, the idea of distributing money by the ECB to citizens in the Eurozone on a per capita basis. We keep hoping that that kind of quantitative easing for the masses, for the people, will happen. But that idea has been floated a number of different times, most recently by Blythe and Lonergan, a paper. And there's, you know, discussion in the radio stations for about a day and a half, and then it just dies as an idea. But austerity now is actually creating such stresses in the economies, even the big economies in Germany, France, Italy, Greece, certainly, Spain, Ireland now, that the sort of political consensus that held our societies together are breaking down.
Yeah.
And fringe parties are coming into being. And in Ireland in particular, it's the growth of independence and indeed the growth of Socialist Workers' Party, Sinn Féin, and the big parties that, particularly Fianna Fáil, that were more or less in power for 50 years, they've been relegated to really on the sidelines. This is huge. And that's in the UK, UKIP, a kind of smart-ass party that nobody paid attention to, is now challenging the Conservatives. Podemos in Spain, as far as I know, is the second biggest party, which is run by ponytailed professor, left-wing. It's unbelievable, and it's beginning to shake the politicians up. So we're hoping that instead of just continuing slide into chaos, that the ECB would be directed to do what it's supposed to do, which is stand behind banks, that's number one, provide the liquidity that's needed, but to do it in a way that's fair for the people.
And that's only going to happen, Ellen, through, I think, a public banking system. It's interesting what Imre was saying there. There is a lot of unrest, particularly here in Ireland at the moment. You know, the point you made there about more independence. So I was looking at the recent polls. It looks like independents are probably taking about 25% of the voting power here. Even yesterday, we had an incident where our Tánaiste, which is like your vice president, our car was surrounded and there was shouts and screams going on.
For two hours.
So, you know, I was at a Kilconomics event last week and there were students there. These were economic students and they came and they were asking questions. People are asking more questions and people are not happy. We need change, you know, and particularly with the banking sector, because money touches everything. You know, everything we do, money touches. If you look at most of the problems here in this country, it's money based or the lack thereof. And this is bringing a kind of unrest out there. But I'm not saying that public banking be the silver bullet, but at least we're getting an alternative. At least we're getting a run at the system where the money's not heading off to the Cayman Islands or wherever they hide their money.
I think we're laboring under a mass delusion in the current era. It goes back to Milton Friedman and this whole idea that inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. In other words, that you can't let more money into the system because that's going to drive up prices. That actually is not what causes inflation. Inflation is usually, almost always, by cost push, by costs going up for different reasons. And one of them is interest rates going up. So the idea of raising the interest rate in order to stop inflation is totally counterproductive. But anyway, so we've been tinkering with economic theory for hundreds of years. Every 20 or 30 years, we change the system. And it, like just this weekend, they changed the system again because they just formalized the bail-in procedures. That means that depositors' money is no longer the depositors' money. It's now an asset of the bank. So anyway, they changed the terms. They changed the deal, or what we thought the deal was. So what money really should be, and where we've gone wrong, it seems to me, is that governments can and should print money in order to pay for the things they need, like infrastructure, because that's what money is. It's a little receipt acknowledging that somebody has done labor or given supplies to we the people collectively, and we the people collectively agree that when they take their little receipt showing that they've done work, when they trade it for other goods and services in the community, we'll honor that.
One of the things when we don't have our own currency, Ireland in the Eurozone does not have its own currency, so we don't have the same flexibility that the UK and the US have. And arising from that in a time of austerity is that the government has to keep its borrowing down because it genuinely is constrained. It is not its own money, and they cannot issue it, as in the way you've described. So the case for water infrastructure investment is a case in point in Ireland. We need to make billions of investment in our infrastructure. The water was in the control of the local authorities, so they provide the drinking water, and they also process the wastewater. And it was all free, essentially, to the consumer. But it was paid for, obviously, in income taxes. The amount of money that is raised by local authorities is very small. Most of the money is raised in central taxes and then redistributed back to the local authorities. And they didn't make much of an investment, it has to be said, in the last 20 years. Now our water quality and wastewater quality is breaking EU regulations, and it must be improved. but our government can't borrow any more under the austerity agreement. So what they're doing is they're trying to borrow off balance sheet. So they created an arm's length company, which is a private company, but wholly owned by the Minister for Finance. And it can borrow in the private market to fund the infrastructure as long as 50% of the receipts are charges to the consumer. Up to 50% can be a subvention by the state and it still counts as off balance sheet. So it's essentially people are terrified in the end of the day is that our water is being privatized and that at any point the Troika or the likes of the Troika can say to our government, A, start paying back that borrowing quicker and you might do it by selling off some of your resources. We've done it already. We sold off our some of our energy generation assets. They looked at selling off our forests, which they nearly did, but then pulled back from. But now we're going to have a valuable utility, Irish Water. And people are, I think, genuinely worried that Irish Water is going to be sold into the private market. I mean, this is another reason I think that we should have a public bank, a large, you know, national public bank, because I think we can still be off balance sheet if a public bank raised the funds for investment in water. The danger is where it's private money on the bond market that is funding at least 50% of the investment. So it's kind of all tied together.
Well, and well, if you borrow privately, it's going to double your cost.
Yes.
And interest is 50% of the cost of infrastructure.
That's correct. And I'm talking maybe in the next 20 years, probably, you know, there's been figures thrown around, you know, it could be 10 billion, 15 billion. Well, you stick on the interest on that, you know. So basically, you could look at this as a revenue stream for the private banking sector.
Yeah, and it should be a revenue stream for the public. Insane to say that you can't borrow because it's just like borrowing for a business that's going to pay off in the end. So you borrow, pay the workers and materials, then you put out the product, which you sell, and then the proceeds from that product pays back the loan. So investment in infrastructure pays for itself, particularly if it's the kind that results in some sort of product that you can sell to the public.
Yeah, you know, a couple of minutes ago there, Ellen, you mentioned about understanding the cycles and history. And I came across a lady once about a year ago. I asked her, I said, how do you know so much about banking, you know, globally? And she said, well, the first thing you have to do is research and go into history, because history repeats itself, particularly in the banking system. So I did some of this research and I came across this guy, George Berkeley. He was actually a bishop. He was born here in 1685. And basically he was a philosopher. There was a couple of things happening around the time he lived. And one thing in particular was they were setting up the Bank of England. And as you know, at one stage was the apex of the whole system. And there was a couple of crashes going on. And he looked at all this as a philosopher and he investigated all of this. And he came up with a plan or a sketch for a national bank. And basically, he was calling for public banks 350 years ago.
Yes, he was born a bit before Benjamin Franklin. So Benjamin Franklin's been called the father of paper money. You could arguably call Berkeley, as we say. I went to University of California, Berkeley, and that was named after.
That's right. That's
your,
correct.
Your Berkeley or Berkeley. So you could call him the father of public banking.
Yes. It was funny. I was looking at some of, you know, historians look at the Scottish guy, Adam Smith, as the kind of...
Father of private banking. He was the father of private banking.
Yeah, well, and it's funny, what happened was he took some of his ideas, banking ideas or economic ideas from Berkeley. Obviously, he went private.
So you have a long tradition of public banking, and this would not really be a break. One interesting thing about going back to the EU, I've written about this before, that Article 23 of the Lisbon Treaty says that the banks, of course, are allowed to borrow from the ECB. They lowered their rates. I think they're below 1% now for bank lending. But that governments cannot borrow from the ECB. But then there's paragraph 2 of that provision says that an exception is made for publicly owned banks. In other words, if you're a government-owned bank, you can borrow at the same rate that the private banks can from the ECB. So that's another good reason to have your own bank. Instead of having to borrow at 5% or 7% or 30% is what Greece was borrowing at one point in their worst days. 30%, imagine what that does to your debt. You could be borrowing at under 1%, just like the bank, if you have a publicly owned bank.
Yeah, that is an option. That's the Lisbon Treaty 123. You know, Ellen, this is all about options. This is we have lots of options out there. What we're trying to get across is we want to be able to present a model that we can follow. Now, as the Sparsigan group is, we cannot present that one because that suits Germany. But it doesn't take an awful lot to change that model that can be used here in Ireland to set up public banks, maybe starting off with two in the capital area and then spreading out across the country. You know, so that's
it's a great place to start. And then when that proves to be effective, then people could start looking at a state-type publicly owned bank.
Yeah. I think once it starts, people will enjoy the benefits of it, and then we can build the system bigger, or we can look at maybe state banks. I think one of the big challenges that we're going to have to overcome here is who actually owns the bank. And the way the Sparkassen Bank is in Germany is that it's not owned by anybody, so it cannot be sold off to private institutions because they could gobble them up. So how that's actually presented is going to be fairly important to the Irish public, because currently at the moment, people don't trust politicians. People do not trust banks. They feel that the banks, the private banking system, has influenced our politicians in some ways, and I think that may be true.
We have to start with doable. The Sparkassen model is an excellent place to start because, as you say, they've got 200 years experience and they're eager to come over and advise on how to set up the system. So that can make the politicians very comfortable. Plus the fact that Germany is a big leader in the EU, so if they're doing it, why shouldn't everybody else be doing the same thing? It obviously works for them. So I think that's great. It's the same problem we have in the U.S. where people say to me, well, why don't you fix the Federal Reserve? Well, we don't have any influence over the Federal Reserve. There's no way that we, the little people, are going to influence Congress to change the Federal Reserve Act. But we can influence our local politicians. So we need to start where we might actually have some success. Like right now, we're working on city and county-owned banks, but also state-owned banks. But cities and counties, you can approach your legislators. One thing I was really impressed with in Ireland was that it's small, relatively small. So it's like, well, we have 34 million people or something in California, which is a state. And how many people do you have?
4.5 million.
Yeah, so you can actually, like, we actually bumped into the Prime Minister when we were, and, you know, he stopped and shook our hand and we talked about public banking. And
I think you're 100% correct, Ellen. You know, there is a kind of an outline plan where we speak to the government, which we have done. I think it's very important how this message gets out to the public, because they're fairly angry at the moment. They're angry at government. They're angry at banks. I think how we get this message across to them, what public banks can do for this country.
The demand for public banks isn't a top priority for the Irish people at the moment because they don't really know about them yet. And politicians are cowards. We feel, I mean, we're learning from yourselves there in California, that if we want it to happen, we have to get the people to demand it. And to demand it, they have to know about it. And that's the problem, because it's quite hard to get discussion of public banks in Irish media. So, I mean, that's great when you come over, because we're able to use you as a kind of an intro. But we have to do an awful lot more work to get the people, the angry people, to start asking for change and saying what that change is demanding public banks. At the moment, they're in negative mode. They know they don't like what they're being offered, but they don't yet know what they should be asking for.
They don't have an alternative. They don't have a solution. And it was interesting at Kilconomics when I was in some of the rooms where the groups were. One of the economists was there, torn, and asked, he says, why are all these people here? I said to him, I know why they're here. They're here because they're looking for answers. The government doesn't have the answers for the moment. It's getting that message out there is the main thing. I'm sure you have the same problem in the US.
So, I mean, one thing about Europe is things are so bad. And in the Eurozone, we have very few options. Like in the US, you have the option of a Federal Reserve doing the right thing and using its money creation powers in the people's interest. We don't have that option here. So really, public banks are our only solution short of leaving the euro. In a way, because of the direness of our situation, it it offers opportunity.
Okay, great. Well, it's been great talking to you.
And it's been great talking to you, Ellen. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. I've been speaking with Noah Kinahan and Emer Oshakru, who have been helping to lead the national effort in Ireland for putting public banking forward as a possible solution to that country's monetary crisis.
On today's Public Banking Report, we're going to take a couple of minutes to talk once again with one of the citizen voices in the field that are working on the public banking movement and to hear what motivates their involvement and their commitment to this issue. Today's comments come from one of the Public Banking Institute's founding members of the board, Anne Tulensef, an aerospace engineer who has been instrumental in developing PBI's missions and organization.
You're basically the closest thing to a rocket scientist that we have in the public banking world. And your technical background wouldn't seem to suggest that you'd have a very strong stand for economic justice and fairness and so forth, which hopefully all of us have in our hearts. But, you know, you've really taken it to another level. How did you take the step to get involved in public banking?
Well, the first thing is I think fairness is actually one of those things that are universal. I think all types can get behind fairness. But most people are unaware that the system is unfair. That's the issue. But this notion of democratizing our money, reclaiming the money power with publicly owned banks, basically keep our money local and out of Wall Street, all these are themes around public banking that I think, without having an expert knowledge of economics and monetary theory, people can get that basic concept that we put all our money in Wall Street, and they do with it what they want. And they have a system that extracts it from us, as opposed to having a public system where the public is in control and we keep our money local and productive and working for us.
Where do you think that it is headed? How do you think that this process is going to work through, this relatively new knowledge, going to work through the society?
I do believe the phrase public banking is a great one. I've read that studies show that public actually has good connotations among people, and I think public banking is almost self-explanatory. So we've been able to basically put the message in two words, as difficult a concept as this is. So I really actually have big hope that slowly but surely the message is going to get out there. So I'm really actually quite hopeful.
That's Anne Tulensef, founding board member of the Public Banking Institute. We'll be talking with other citizen activists working on this issue in coming editions of the Public Banking Report. That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.